Live from Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics, featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by our panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public servants, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight featuring commentary by Stephanie Hitt, T.O. Hardiman, and Anthony Anderson. Our program tonight coming to you from our home base at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago, where our toll-free lines are open at 1-800-723-8289. That's 1-800-723-8289. If you'd like to email us a comment, btb@museum.tv. And if you'd like to join us on the World Wide Web, www.beyondthebeltway.com. Tonight, for the next couple of hours, we're going to be talking about what has been a major topic of discussion in this country for the last month, and that is what can we do to reduce school violence and what can we do to reduce violence in our society. Obviously, tomorrow marks the one-month anniversary of the tragedy in Connecticut, where over 25 students and teachers were killed. And tonight, we're going to be talking about what the federal administration and what each and every one of us can be doing to hopefully decrease the likelihood of something like that happening again. The president, as you know, in the wake of that shooting, appointed the Vice President Joe Biden to look into the issue. And the president and vice president, the vice president has met with members of the gun rights organizations in the country, including the National Rifle Association. Last week he met, and I was very pleased that he met with leaders of Hollywood and the gaming industry. And also there's been some discussions with the mental health community as well, because, as you know, if you've heard me for the last month, my soapbox has been that if we want to solve this problem, it's a combination of guns and mental health and some of the culture of media violence that we have in the country. So a combination of those, I want to get everybody's thought about that, and I want to get your advice as well, whether or not, or what you would like to have the vice president say and recommend to the president. Those recommendations are due early next week. Also, a common denominator of tonight's broadcast, it's not a left-right Republican-Democrat debate, but it is with concerned Americans and concerned parents. We have a total of 13 children that are represented at this table. I have one, and Stephanie Hitt, you have four. Our other guests have four as well. From a mother's perspective, you're a suburban mother. Your background is also your former assistant United States attorney in New York, so you've got a legal background as well. But as a mother, what would you hope would be included in Vice President Biden's recommendations to the president?
I think one of the most important factors is looking at the culture and the influences. I'm generally the feeling that the problem isn't necessarily with the weapons of choice. It's with what is driving what typically the young men in our society today, whether it's in the inner city or whether it's in, you know, suburban Connecticut, to do horrific, terrible things. And as a parent, we need to have a better sense that something is going to help us help those people.
T.O. Hardiman also joins us. He is with Ceasefire Illinois. He is on the streets. He is probably the principal spokesperson for the violence, the rampant violence that we've had in the city of Chicago. Also a father of four.
Yes.
As a father and as a professional within the violence-reducing business, if you will, or community, what would you like to see the vice president recommend?
What I would like to see the vice president recommend is that we need to take a look at the public health aspects of this issue of violence, because here in an inner city like Chicago and throughout our nation, a lot of young people grow up in a culture of violence, and we have to learn how to teach and educate young people they can unlearn violent behavior, because it's modeled behavior and it's passed down from generation to generation. And if we get on the front end of it as a public health issue, I think we can really help raise a more healthier, you know, like a nation of young people that understand that violence can become a thing of the past. So I'm looking for more policy in the arena of public health.
Also joining us this evening is Anthony Anderson. He is in the criminal justice system and has been for the last 20 years, a former U.S. Marine. Anthony, again, father of four, your answer to the same question.
One of the things that I hope that will come from this meeting would be that the
the vice president would advise the president on, you know, getting some meaningful legislation, especially as it relates to background checks on individuals who want to own firearms, and, you know, strengthen some of our laws that are currently on the books, minimum sentencing, things of that nature. I mean, there are some parameters, I believe, that we can work within. I don't think that the NRA is going to be too happy, but, I mean, those are some of the stuff that I think that's, you know, going to make our society more fair in the long run. And you have to look at the sustainability of our actions moving forward after the implementation of this new policy.
Stephanie, do you believe that, you know, obviously there's public support for this. There's a lot of media attention because of the last week, and now you've got the focus of the bully pulpit of the White House and the vice president involved in this. But again, the stories are circulating how powerful the NRA is, the $20 million that they spent, 50% of the members of Congress have received some funding. You yourself are a new member of the NRA. But do you believe that will the American voter or the American parent who is not a member of the NRA, who wants to see things changed and improved, are they going to get a fair shake when this is debated in Congress?
Well, the thing is, there's a lot of people out there that think that the gun itself is the problem. And that's where, you know, they're going to feel like there's a fair shake if that's what Congress is. That's the only issue that Congress deals with, and that is gun control.
Would you acknowledge that the gun is part of the problem?
It is only, I'm not necessarily going to acknowledge it, because I think the real problem is the people using the guns. And we can talk about that.
Do you think the gun is part of the problem, Teo?
Well, I think it's two parts of the problem. The gun, and on one end, and then it's the thinking. It's the people. We have to change behaviors. You can't get around it, because if a person is premeditating and thinking violently, he may use a gun, a knife, or whatever's in front of him at that time, him or her at that time.
Anthony?
Definitely. The gun has to be in the equation. I mean, it is, after all, the basis of why we're having a discussion in the first place. So yes, the gun has to be a part of this discussion.
How do we more effectively and efficiently root out those in our society who have some form of mental disability, so that they are identified, so they are not sold weapons?
I think this is the biggest challenge we're going to face, and this is why you asked me, will people feel? People might, on a superficial level, feel like something's going to be done, but we had an assault weapons ban from 94 to 2000. Didn't really dramatically change crime rates, and it didn't really dramatically change massacre rates. And so the problem is, people might feel good about the window dressing, but this is what is so hard about this, is we are talking about controlling people's behavior trying to tap into that.
I want to get this out. Do you believe that someone with mental instability has a right to have a gun?
No.
Absolutely not.
Absolutely not.
You know,
no,
one of the problems that's facing this country.
You think the NRA would agree with that?
I believe they would.
In other words, when
yes.
we talk about the Second Amendment, we're saying the Second Amendment doesn't apply to someone with mental illness?
There is a very, very clear very clear through the case law and Second Amendment that those that have been deemed mentally incompetent do not have that right is infringed.
Well,
we're gonna have to pause. When I come back, I want to
very clear
continue this discussion of mental illness and where it fits into the big broad picture. 1-800-723-8229. Wherever you're listening from coast to coast, and I know we have people that live in rural America, we have people that live in urban America. I know your different perspectives that you come and bring to this debate. I'd be very interested in having you participate in our open discussion this evening. 1-800-723-8229. What would you like Vice President Biden to recommend to President Obama and to Congress? From Big Rock, Texas to Little Rock, Arkansas, you're listening to Beyond the Beltway. 1-800-723-8229 is the discussion. We will engage you in that conversation in just a few moments. But one of the observations I have is that in the wake of the Connecticut massacre and the theater shooting in Aurora, Colorado, or in the wake of any of these spree shootings, there's always a discussion the first discussion is always about the gun. Then you find out that the person involved was deranged, and there's some common denominators of activities that they had. But mental health and mental illness is part of that discussion. When you talk about widespread violence in urban America, like in the city of Chicago, the discussion of whether the people that are pulling the trigger and killing these people are mentally ill never comes up.
Right.
Teal, these are the people you deal with. You deal with the people who have been shot. You deal with the people that shot them. Is mental illness an overlooked discussion of this whole culture of violence that we're talking about?
Yeah, mental health is definitely an issue there, because a lot of young men that shoot one another, their friends condone the behavior. You know, I've heard guys say, I'm with you whether you're right or wrong. And they're just actually like coexisting out there and promoting this, you know, crazy behavior. It's okay to shoot people. That's the reason. See, violence has been around since the beginning of time. Let's be honest about that. Right. Over in Rwanda, you had 900,000 people slaughtered within 90 days. So this is nothing new.
Right.
But the point is that no television or movies influencing those particular like atrocities that took place. But the thing is, yeah, mental health is a serious issue. There's no difference between a young guy in the neighborhood compared to the young man who shot and killed all the people over in Connecticut. There's no difference. Mental health is definitely a problem, because if you think it's okay to shoot people, that's because you have to be locked into a mentality. And it's a mental health line that you cross when you end up shooting people.
So the definition for you of who is mentally unstable might be a much broader definition than at least where we are in the media right now.
Without a doubt, I think there needs to be some more exploration as it relates to mental health, because a lot of these young men, like I say, they think it's okay and nobody's calling them out on it. That's a big problem.
And work with these type of individuals, I've seen that too. I mean, it's that pervasive culture in which these individuals think that that's more of the norm,
right,
and it's accepted behavior. I mean, whether it's in the adult division with the Illinois Department of Corrections or the juvenile division with the Illinois Department of Juvenile Justice,
right,
I see that same mentality in which, hey, listen, what I'm doing is just a way for me to survive, and that's the way I look at it,
right,
as opposed to me saying, hey, listen, something about what's going on is not the norm, and I need to change my ways.
Let's go to calls. Let's go to Sam in Austin, Texas, listening to us on KLBJ. Good evening. You're on the air.
Hi, gentlemen. First of all, I wanted to say that I think it's wonderful that everybody is trying to come up with a solution to a horrible problem. But I think the sad truth is that we as a society cannot collectively come up with solutions to problems that occur on an individual basis, even if that problem creates something so horrible as what happened to those children. But I think what you brought up, Bruce, was mental health, and I think that's the key right there, because I think everybody that's willing to do something so horrible as to harm, you know, another person or multiple people who are in a very vulnerable and innocent and defenseless kind of situation, I mean, that needs to be discussed here. The fact that it's always a defenseless victim in these circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's the family that's deteriorated, and for all these individuals out there that have chosen to do something so horrible, it all happens on an individual basis, one person at a time, and society hasn't failed them. But somebody in their life.
But Sam, let me just ask you one question, because I might disagree with your last point that society hasn't failed them, and the person that I'm thinking about, and the person when I do these programs, the person I think about, I obviously think about the victims, but that's a sad story. The other sad story is the mothers, and in some cases the fathers, sometimes all alone, without another spouse in the house. And they're dealing with a child that in their heart they know is not right, and they can't deal with them. And because of economic circumstances, they don't have the money to seek professional help. Maybe they don't have the money for medication, if medication is required. And they're frustrated. It's like the people who live in the urban areas of Chicago and every major city. Many of them, most of them, are decent, honest, hardworking people, but they are captives in their own house. They can't let their children out. But children are teenagers. They want to get out. They want to play with their friends. And so they, as a parent, they're saying, okay, we're going to let you play in the front yard. Well, the story that we hear almost night after night in Chicago is some innocent kid is playing on the stoop of their front porch, and that's where they're killed, with their parents. Whoa. Not having a place where parents or more places where parents can go to seek help in parenting, in helping their kids. That's the thing I would like to see come out of this. Go ahead.
Well, let me say that, you know, when I said about not, you know, society bearing no responsibility, I don't mean that entirely. I agree with you that society does impact individuals just as individuals influence, you know, the society as a whole. But I think what you cited there was a circumstance where, you know, someone's an innocent victim of somebody that's willing to do something really bad. So the real problem is not the innocent child sitting in the front yard. You know, those people in society aren't doing anything wrong. But the person that comes along and is willing to harm someone, murder someone, take from somebody, those are the people that if you look at their lives, they had a failure in their life, and it maybe was that they had a single parent and they didn't have a father around.
I want to ask Teo about that because this is what he deals with every day. And last year, 506 people were murdered in the city of Chicago.
Well, you know, violence spreads like infectious disease. That's the bottom line. If a lot of people are thinking that way, no matter if they have a father in the household or not, it does help to have a father in the house. Don't get me wrong, but you have a lot of stories. Right now in Chicago, we're working with 1,173 high-risk individuals, known guys that participate in violent behavior. 30% of them, we got them into jobs. Another 35%, we re-enrolled them in school, and we're spending quality time with the remaining percentage of individuals. But most important, they have not reoffended for a year. That's very important. So at the same time, it doesn't really matter what household you come from, because if you have to look beyond your dinner table for a role model, you may already be lost to a degree. So that happens.
In a drive-by situation, though, Teo.
Yes.
The person who's in the car, or the people that are in the car that are driving by, and they may be randomly spraying.
Right.
In your experience, do you think that in many cases it is gang related, and that the person that they're shooting really is viewed by them as an enemy, or is it really as random as the media tends to portray the shootings, at least in the city that you are most familiar with?
Good question. What happens in Chicago, you have a lot of interpersonal violence. A guy may be a member of a gang. He gets into a conflict with somebody, and then they might say it's gang-related, but it's really an individual conflict. Then he goes to get some of his buddies. You have guys that are part of different gangs that hang out together, and they end up shooting people together as well. So in Chicago, what led to the increase in homicides in 2012, you've had more internal fighting with the different existing gangs. Then you've had this phenomenon with this social media gang banging taking place in Chicago. People think they're going to get these big record contracts if they post more violent content in their videos on YouTube. So you have a lot of misunderstandings. People are being shot for some of the simplest things that you ever heard of in the world. Real quick, we had a guy that was shot and killed because some water fell from a air conditioner on a girl's dress while she was going on prom, but they were also having a water balloon fight, you know, next door to the house. They thought somebody hit her with a water balloon, but it was really the air conditioner leaked on the girl's dress, and her family members came over and killed the guy. They thought they threw the water balloon at her, and they found later on that it was air conditioner. So what I'm saying is that it's in the thinking. People think violence is okay, and we have to really change that to the best of our ability.
How do you do that? Where do you start, Anthony? Because it seems to me that you're planting the seed that there's a culture of violence that's perpetuated by the media, the music industry, the gaming industry. Mm-hmm. And again, when I think media talks about the gaming industry, that appears to be a common denominator in some of these mass school shootings that involve primarily white kids, the shooting of white kids, and the perpetrator being white kids.
Right.
But now, how does that relate to what's going on in the black community? Is violent video games a problem in the black community?
Absolutely.
Or is music and movies more of a problem?
I think it's a little bit of both. I mean, you look at the glamorization of violence in movies in addition to the glamorization of violence in these videos. I mean, you can look at some of the most vehement, vile things on earth just by listening to some of this rap music, and it makes absolutely no sense to the average individual. And when you see these young people listening to this music and acting out on what they listen to, it becomes a whole nother world for these guys. You have a lot of these young guys, especially in Chicago, you have a lot of young rappers who actually go to court, 26 in California, not 26, but 1100 South Hamilton, and you know, you have a lot of these young guys showing up to these court dates with these guys, looking as though, hey, listen, this guy's, you know, he's finally showing up to his court date, he's looking all good, he's got cars, he's got girls, he got all this money. And so that, to them, that looks like, hey, listen, that's some I want to do. I want to emulate what I see in terms of this whole persona that these musicians are putting on for these young kids and these other people within the community. And
so, all right,
it becomes sort of a self-fulfilling prophecy as you look at the music, as you listen to the music, look at the movies, and then you see these young people act out what they see and hear.
Stephanie.
Well, I was going to say, you know, what it seems to me that, you know, whether it's gang-related violence in the inner city of Chicago, whether it's Columbine type of violence with this whole goth thing, or whether it's, you know, somebody who's has an illness, who's you know, in Newtown. In every single one of these cases, I think what you're saying, going back to your earlier point, is in every case there are parents there who are frustrated, who feel like overwhelmed. That whether it's the culture, the games, the environment, the inability to get mental health assistance, whatever, those parents are the best position to help those kids, and they're feeling overwhelmed by what they're confronted with, whether it's a bureaucracy on mental health or whether it's a game they can't control.
We're going to pick up there. Back shortly. I'm Bruce Dumont from Chicago. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Thank you very much for joining us tonight. Teal Hardiman is here. He is director of Cease Fire Illinois. That is the leading group that is out there in the streets of Chicago trying to reduce violence. They are in a variety of other cities. And Teal, again, father of four for tonight's discussion. Yes. Important to include that. How did you get involved in this work? And again, for those who are not familiar with Cease Fire Illinois and that it exists in other cities, what's the describe it in 100 words or less? Or 50?
Yeah, I got involved in the work with Cease Fire because blessed are the peacemakers. My birthday is on September 21st. I won't say the year, but I was born on the International Day of Peace. And I was raised in the Henry Horner Projects on the west side of Chicago and the Avalon Park community on the south side. So gangs were all around me growing up, and I always wanted to stand up for the underdog. So this has been a destiny for me. Okay, Ceasefire is a public health model founded by Dr. Gary Slutkin, who's an epidemiologist, and we treat violence as an infectious disease. And we're looking at it to the point where we can change behavior. So Ceasefire is a public health model. We're working in 15 cities across America, including Baltimore, Philadelphia, New Orleans, and a few other cities. And we're working in a few other countries as well. We're working over in England now. We're working over in South Africa. So the model is proven. We have the Department of Justice did an evaluation on Ceasefire. It's a proven model.
Would you say that that violence in the country is at epidemic proportions?
Yes, I look at violence as
even though crime rates are down. They talk about how crime rates are down.
Yeah.
But homicide, at least in Chicago, is up.
No, because it can spread at any time. You know, homicides up in Chicago, homicides up in Philadelphia and New Orleans as well. If you take a look, let's go out of America for right now. Go to Kingston, Jamaica. Go to Juarez, Mexico. Go to Brazil, the country of Brazil. Homicides up in a lot of those different countries out there. So it's not just a Chicago thing or the United States. It spreads like an infectious disease. I talked about it earlier about Rwanda. You can talk about what happens over in a lot of the countries over the years. So violence has to be treated as an epidemic. I definitely look at it as an epidemic.
Stephanie Hitt also joins us. She is a mother of four, formerly on the staff of Rudy Giuliani when he is the United States Attorney for Manhattan in New York. Anthony Anderson also joins us. Anthony has, for the last 20 years, he has been with the Illinois Criminal Justice Group organization, and he is in Warrenville. And you deal, briefly describe what you do. You deal with the only place in Illinois where bad women go.
Yes, primarily we deal with juvenile offenders.
Criminal women. Bad women may go in a variety of areas.
Well, they're juvenile. They're in the ages between 13 and 21. They've done some bad things in their lives. I mean, for other reasons, but for the most part, these individuals are in our custody, and we're there to maintain order with these individuals.
And before the show, you found out that you and Teal grew up in the same neighborhood.
Exactly. I grew up in Henry Horner Projects along with Teal.
Yes, ma'am.
I lived in 1900 West Washington. He actually grew up in 1847 West Washington. It's the next building over, actually.
Now, you said something during the break, and again, we don't have to name names because we don't want to glorify people, but you said that when you guys were growing up, and you're similar in age, that there was only, three or four big gangs?
Primarily,
tell us how the gang culture has changed from your perspective.
There were primarily about three or four major gangs in the cities of Chicago. You either fell under the people's nation or the folks nation. Right. Now, you fast forward to the year 2012, 2013, you now have the same people's and folks nation, but now there are 600 different factions of these same gangs. And when you have these—
Literally 600, that
600
many?
Different right. factions of these same gangs. So and imagine that, Bruce. None of these different organizations have any leadership to speak of. I mean, if you could say that in the gang, but you know, if you don't have anybody who's in control, then everybody's doing their own thing. They're renegading, like they like to say. They're renegades.
Deal?
Yes, very true. Excuse me. Sorry about that.
It's all right.
Yeah, what happens? You got a lot of renegade factions out there, basically doing what they want to do. I had to take a pause. Sorry.
That's
about
okay.
That.
We're going to take a call while you take a little water, and let's go to Algonquin, Illinois, where Marie is listening to us on WLS Radio. Sorry. You're on the air.
Yes, good evening, Bruce. Well, first of all, I really haven't heard any recommendation as to how to make our schools safer as a result of the horrific tragedies out there in Connecticut. Other than, I believe the NRA did have the one recommendation of having armed guards at all of the schools. As a proud member of the NRA, I generally agree with their positions, but I don't with that one. And I guess President Obama doesn't either, even though I understand his daughters do have armed guards in the school where they attend, which, of course, is, I think, certainly called for.
Well, one story that came out today that may bring a little joy to you, and that is that Barbara Boxer, who is one of the most liberal members of the United States Senate, she has said that she could support a recommendation that she is urging Vice President Biden to participate in, and that is to have some form of federal aid for guards going into the schools. Armed guards, either uniformed or ununiformed. By the way, I assume you like that idea. I want to get everybody's
I don't like the idea, only as a matter of last resort, except maybe in very high crime areas where that might be necessary. What I would like to see the Vice President recommend to the President is that all of the public schools in the country have a very sophisticated surveillance system. I have seen that type of system working, and one that would cover all the entrances, exits to school buildings. I know in many schools are locked during the normal school day. They of course do allow for doors to open out.
Let's let Anthony respond to that. And by the way, we should mention, by the way, in the case of the Connecticut massacre, that school was locked down.
Right.
But go ahead.
That's what I wanted to say is, she said, Maria, the caller, was talking about some of the high crime areas. Well, if you look at the last few mass shootings, I mean, you wouldn't consider Newtown, Connecticut, an actual high crime area.
No.
Or if you go to Colorado, an instance where those other individuals were massacred at in the movie theater, that wasn't a high crime area either. So if you look at it, I mean, You can't pick and choose where you think violence may occur. Violence in our society nowadays can occur anywhere at any given time.
Right. Well, and that's the point, is that actually in a lot of inner city schools, there are armed guards already. This is not a new and unusual idea. And I think the situation here is it's in the unpredictable, the least safe feeling, the most safe feeling areas where we're seeing these problems, like a shopping mall, a movie theater, and a school. And so
that's why it gets the massive exposure.
Exactly.
But, And this gets this is a little touchy question, but there are more people shot in, whether it's Chicago, probably Los Angeles as well, probably more people were shot and maybe even killed that weekend than in Connecticut. But the people that were killed were black or minorities.
Yes.
So I want to. We have two African Americans at the table. I mean. When we talk about, you've just said, Teo, that you want that there has to be a respect for the value of life, and that too often in these gang situations or murder, there's no value for life. So I'm saying, as a bigger, broader society, do we value the lives of young black people less than we do of young white children?
Well, there needs to be some, conversation around that issue, because, yes, Chicago, out of 506 homicides in the year 2012, about 65% to 70% of black-on-black homicides. And so I don't see a whole lot of noise being made when it comes down to African-American youth killing one another. And then the Connecticut shooting, I really feel bad for the families in Connecticut. I want to make that clear. But it should not have taken the Connecticut massacre for this conversation to be going on all across the nation with world leaders as well. This conversation should have took place when Darren Albert was beaten to death on the south side of Chicago, because that made world news all around the world for almost 2 or 3 months in a row.
Stephanie.
Well, and I think, you know, I don't want to underestimate how serious all of these crimes are. But there's no doubt that if in the south side of Chicago, if someone walked into a school, a kindergarten classroom, and shot 20 kids, there would not there. I do believe there would be the same outrage.
No question.
We are talking about young, innocents, large group, massive, premeditated.
Right.
That is that it, and it's a unique crime.
Could we say, and then we're going to move on to another call, but I'm going to offer one suggestion. I'm going to answer my own question at the top of the show. What would I like to recommend? And I said that, you know, when the NRA chief got pummeled last week for suggesting that that schools be armed, I supported that idea, not because it's an NRA idea. It seems to me that there needs to be in every school, just as we now, at least I feel safer on an airplane in the wake of 9/11, that there may be a federal marshal on that plane whose job it is to take someone out if they tried to commandeer the plane. I would feel comfortable if I was a parent and I had students in the Chicago public schools, which I do not, or any public school, that someone in that school, not a teacher, I do not want it to be a teacher. Mm-hmm. I want teachers to teach.
That's right.
But I would like to know that someone in that school is armed. They can be plain clothes. They don't have to have a uniform on. And I can be on either side of that discussion as to which wiser, because I don't know, but I can offer a suggestion on it. And here's one other point. We now have troops coming home from Afghanistan. I would suggest that this is a work training program for people who are coming back in looking for jobs to be secure, young, healthy, vigorous security guards, not the 65-year-old guy who can barely get his gun out of the holster. And there's a few security guards that are like that. I see that's a way in which we can address some of these issues. Anthony, what do you think of that
absolutely.
Idea?
Absolutely. I mean, there has to be some concern once you bring a weapon into the school. But once that individual is a professional, trained individual, I think that'll you know, calm some of the fears that parents may have when they send their young kids to schools and they don't know whether or not that kid is going to be coming home or not. But if they know that there's a trained individual, there may be some chance that if there's an individual that's walking into that school, you know, unauthorized, that, you know, he may get stopped right at the door before he comes in to commit some sort of crime.
I want to get everybody's response to that. Listening, 1-800-723-8029. Lots of callers as well. We will hear from them when we roll on from Chicago, from coast to coast and border to border. Every Sunday night, I'm Bruce Dumont. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. We will go to calls in just a moment, but I would like to take a moment for those listening on our flagship station, WLS Radio in Chicago. You may have heard the news earlier today that Jake Hartford, a personality for many, many years on WLS Radio, has lost his life.
Wow.
And our condolences to the family of Jim Edwards. Again, his on-air name was Jake Hartford. Again, a longtime member of the WLS family here in Chicago. And again, our condolences go to him. And again, there is an opportunity on the WLS website to offer your condolences to the family. So please do that if so moved. And again, we work together occasionally. We always worked at the same station. We didn't know each other real well, but when there's a loss in the family, we offer our condolences to Jim Edwards and his family and those that are left behind.
Okay.
Let's now go to Tamara, listening to us on WLS Radio in Chicago, a probation officer. Go ahead, Tamara.
Yes, thank you. I am a probation officer of 16 years at 26 in California, and I work in the bond court, and I'm in the pretrial division, which means that everyone that I see every day, they get their bond. And so I see a lot of people for UUWs and shootings on the weekends. And my point is this. Part of the interview is finding out if they have any mental illnesses.
Mm-hmm.
And
right.
More times than not, they'll say, well, first I'll say, were you in special ed classes? Well, yes. Are you on medication for anxiety or depression? Well, yes, I have
schizoid affective, or I am either bipolar, or, you know, they have a lot of pathology going on there. And that, coupled with the fact that they had a gun, and that's what they're in there for, unless they get probation, which indeed we do have a mental health division, and unless they get that, and let's just say they go straight to prison for it, there's no help for them. Mm-hmm. And then we also ask them, well, where's your mother and father? Oh, well, my mother's in here. Well, what do you mean here? Well, she's incarcerated. She's downstate. Mm-hmm. So as an African-American, mm-hmm. someone who has lived in Chicago, born and raised, and I thank God I have three children that have survived the Chicago public school system mm-hmm. that are now in college. It is very, very tough. They've taken away, and when I say they, I just mean the government. More money needs to be put into our communities for mental health centers.
Yes.
We have the gangs out here. I work at 26 in California. I won't even begin to name all the gangs. We go to gang training every year. The gangs that have basically taken over Chicago.
That's right.
Between the gangs, the mental health, and the accessibility of guns, that is a recipe for what has been going on in Chicago. There's what is it, the saying now is, come visit Chicago, you know, get murdered. It's awful. And yeah. when you work there, and my children were little when I started, and there were, you know, I come home and I talk about it, and they hear me talk about it, and like I said, they did survive. They went to grade school and high school, Chicago public schools. I'm a product of Chicago public schools.
Well, Tamara, you, the way you phrased it, and I think this is, it's a very compelling way that you phrased it. Your children survived the Chicago public schools.
Yes.
They didn't graduate from the – they may have. But you use the word survived, and that really is – that's what you see. You see those – unfortunately, T.O., you see too many that don't survive.
Yeah, a lot of guys drop out, a lot of females due to a lot of circumstances. But I'm glad the young lady brought up the issue of mental health because across the nation, people don't realize a lot of people suffer from mental health issues. And they're out there in society acting as if they're okay. And then family members are condoning the behavior. And then what's worse is that their friends and peers are condoning the behavior.
I think society as a whole would be better served, especially in the Chicagoland area. Yeah. Would be better served if they were to, you know, close a few of these facilities down and take those resources and put them into these communities, especially where these areas where there's known violence. I mean, there's pervasive violence. And if they could attack that issue or that problem, I think we'll go a long way in Chicago if that were to happen.
But, you know, it's interesting. A few weeks ago, there was on this very show, we had a principal from from a Chicago public school system.
Right.
And, you know, again, we're talking, as Tamara was saying, you know, one of the areas that is a front line is the Chicago public school system. And yet we heard over and over how the teachers, the administrators, their hands are completely tied. There's no support. There's no way that a teacher can even have the one-on-one conversation with the parent mm-hmm. or with the counselors to talk about who, in fact, needs help.
As
and
a matter
to
of
get
fact,
those
there,
services.
Is there, and again, I hate to ask this near the end of the hour, but mm-hmm. and it will generate calls, but is mandatory background checks? Is that something you could support as a new member of the NRA? Mandatory background checks. Would you support that?
You know, in the general sense, yes. But as we get into it, and this is where it gets in trouble, is as you start going through background checks, you're going to find that there's, in some ways, they're overbroad, and some ways they exclude the wrong people. Background
and they
checks
can
you
be
have
abused.
To define exactly. You have to be very careful in how you define the categories of people that are going to be marked through a system, tracked, databased, and how they're going to be excluded.
Well, even before you get a FOID card here in Illinois, a firearms owner identification card in Illinois, you have to go through a background check. So, I mean, to me personally, having a background check to obtain
even if you buy something at a gun show.
Not at a gun show.
Well,
Could we say that the gun show loophole it has to be closed.
Is something has got to be closed.
It has to be closed. The issue has to be addressed. In addition to the gun show loophole, another few things is this. For the sale, for the purchase, And if you lose a gun, it has to be documented. Somewhere down the line, if a person sells a gun, loses a gun, or purchases a gun, it has to go back to that individual. Right. Deal?
No, I agree with what everybody's saying there today, without a doubt. But I wanted to hit your viewers and listeners with a heavyweight punch right now. So I don't know what's going on here. But anyway, this is what's happening. When you lock up a guy, let's say a guy has a lightweight sexual problem.
You got 30 seconds.
Then you lock him up in a jail where everybody has full-blown AIDS, whatever the case may be. What happens is that you go in one way, you come out more infected. That's what happens with this culture of violence as well. And I'll get more into it during the next hour.
Okay, great. Good setup. For those listening to us on radio, we will be back for another full hour. For those of you who are watching us on television, I wish you could be with us for the next hour. Thanks to Teal Hardiman from Ceasefire Illinois, Anthony Anderson from the Illinois Juvenile Justice Organization, and also Stephanie Hitt. They're all parents of four children. I'm a parent of one. And again, we thank you very much for being with us in this television version of Beyond the Beltway. Again, another full hour for those listening coast to coast on radio. Phone lines remain open at 1-800-723-8029. Those standing on the line, you'll be first when we come back on the other side of news. I'm Bruce Dumont. Back shortly. Live from Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont with hour number two of Beyond the Beltway. Tonight featuring commentary by Stephanie Hitt, Teal Hardiman, and Anthony Anderson. They're all interested in, obviously, helping resolve some of the issues of growing violence both at schools and in the streets of America. And they are all parents. And we are talking about some of the recommendations that Vice President Biden will send to the president and to Congress in coming days. And we've been talking about guns. We've been talking about mental health. We've been talking about having armed guards in the public schools. We talked briefly about also popular culture and the media and the role that it plays in making life difficult for parents. And again, sort of the soapbox that I'm on is just the frustration that parents must have wherever they're listening. If their son or daughter has some mental disease or some they're mentally challenged in some way, and there is no place for them to go for help. And they may know in their heart that their child will act in an antisocial way, and they can't do anything about it until something flares like what happened a month ago tomorrow in Connecticut. So tonight we're talking about a wide variety of issues and trying to see if there's some things that we could agree on. And obviously, in all of these discussions, the National Rifle Association is portrayed by the media as the big bad lobbying group because they're out there defending the Second Amendment. They've come up with some suggestions that they think that are important. In fact, the idea of having an armed guard in schools was something that came out from the NRA a week ago. And I guess cooler heads have prevailed, at least in some discussion, that maybe that isn't such a really bad idea. As I said, I don't think they should be teachers. But again, we've got to start thinking a broadly based. For the last, 5-6 years in this country, we've talked about the need for a comprehensive immigration reform plan. Well, this is a comprehensive plan. No one particular gun law is going to solve this problem. It's a collective, a variety of things. And we're going to turn to Joseph in Crown Point, Indiana, listening to us on WLS to begin the discussion in hour number two. Go ahead, Joseph, with your question.
Well, good evening, all. Like, happy to be online.
Thank you.
How can I phrase this? I live in Indiana. I work in Chicago. Geographically, we're in essence the same. We get the same television, the same radio. Obviously, I'm listening to you, Bruce. Yet, for as long as I can remember, and I've been a firearm owner and carrier for over 20-plus years, we've had concealed carry in Indiana. There are background checks. You have to get cleared to get a permit to carry. But even if you don't have a permit, you can own a weapon without the Illinois FOID card. We don't have anything similar in Indiana. You just have a waiting period if you don't have a handgun permit to purchase a weapon. Yet, we don't even have a fourth of the violence that goes on in Chicago. Not even that the murder rate is astronomical in Chicago compared to any community in Northwest Indiana. Geographically, we're the same type of people. I just don't understand why we can have so many firearms in Indiana. We don't have the problems, but we have the problem in the violence in Illinois.
Let's let Tio tackle that. Stay on the line, Joe.
Well, Chicago's just a different beast, okay? You have the history of a lot of the gangs that were birthed in Chicago from the 70s all the way up until now. In the 70s, the gangs were fighting just for different philosophies, building the ranks and the numbers. In the 80s, the gangs took over the drug trade, which led a lot of the guys were making money from 1980 to 1995. And in 1995, something happened in the state of Illinois. The Illinois Department of Corrections actually locked the prisons down, which meant that a lot of the leaders were actually sent away. They were sent to, like, these isolated places like Towns, Florence, Colorado. So you had no leadership. And the renegades took over. I call them the gym shoe boys, the hip-hop generation. So what happens, because of the history of violence in Chicago, that's why you have the magnitude of the problem, because a lot of these guys are growing up. I met with some 12-year-olds in the Inglewood community about 2 months ago, and these young guys told me they hate the guys two blocks away from them. I asked them, why do you hate those guys two blocks away from you? They say their brothers hate them guys. We've always hated those guys. So you got people being raised up in this culture of violence. That's why Chicago is different from Indiana. But in Gary, Indiana, you do have some high homicide rates over in Gary, Indiana.
Absolutely.
I just say that.
Go ahead, brother. Say that. I mean, if just a few years ago, Gary, Indiana, was known as the murder capital of USA, and it was because of the violence that was permeated throughout Gary, Indiana.
Right.
And again, to get back to your point, Chicago is a totally different beast from Gary, Indiana. In Chicago, you probably have over 500,000 blacks, probably in an area, half the size of Gary, Indiana. But it's totally condensed.
Well, that's why I think it's important for those that have just tuned in.
Yes.
The media focus has been in the wake of what happened, tragedy in Connecticut. Mm-hmm. That was very young people being slaughtered in their schools by an obviously deranged young man. Mm-hmm. All right, we've heard that story before, where mental health was the issue, the access to gun made it easier. And in this particular case, it was complicated because the mother had guns. She was the first victim. Her guns were purchased legally. It was at home. She was homeschooled. The laws that Vice President Biden and the president are trying now to propose, they would not have stopped what happened in
Absolutely
Connecticut.
Absolutely.
And the question that I have is, but that challenge is different than the challenge of the violence that takes place in urban areas. And I'm trying to find out if there's some basic things. I think one thing we said in hour number one is if there was an armed guard in every school, that might help, might, not always, it might have helped. We had a caller suggest, would a sophisticated monitoring system work? That might help. It might speed up a response. I don't know. But in the case of what happened in Connecticut, the guy broke into the school. The school was locked down. So now we're dealing with some of the other issues. And one of the issues that we got to just at the end of that first hour, and you sort of threw a roundhouse out there about what needs about the other sort of ticking time bomb that's out there for those people that just tuned into the show. Repeat that to you.
What happens if you have a person with like a lightweight sexual behavior problem? I'm putting them in a context of looking at behavior now, and you lock that person up with people that are fully infected with the HIV virus or the AIDS virus without protection. Now this individual becomes totally infected. And just to give you an example of what I'm talking about, if you lock up a guy on the street, he's a marginally involved young man in the street life. Now you send him to the county jail. He has a small amount of marijuana on him. He may have stolen a car. He may be involved in some type of marginal level gang activity. Now once he goes to the county jail, he has to become a full-fledged member. So he's becoming an intern once he gets locked up with people that have worse behaviors than this young man or female, and now you kind of contribute to the overall culture of violence and gang culture.
And do you have to have? I want both of you to answer, Anthony and Tio. Within the black community at this moment in history, do you have to have a prison record to have credibility in your own neighborhood?
Unfortunately, that's the case. I mean, if you look back at the way Chicago was at first, I mean, I grew up in the Henry Horner Projects. You had Henry Horners, you had the Ida B. Wells, you had Rockwell Gardens. So, you know, if people look at it, you had massive amounts of people in these lower socioeconomic scales here, and they all grew up together with one another. And, you know, being a part of the gang was seen as, you know, you were seen as somebody big in our communities. And so, you know, that tradition, I guess to say, is that legacy has did nothing but
pass. When we come back, we're going to switch back to guns, and we're going to ask the question, assault weapons, should they be banned? Or is that the political fight that will be the toughest for the president to win? And is that a wise investment of his time and effort? Back shortly from Chicago, 1-800-723-8289. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Thanks very much for joining us tonight. I asked the question before I went to the break about whether or not assault weapons should be banned. That is one of the things that is being bantied around as the president explores what he can do. It is perhaps part of a broader issue, and we've got people already that want to comment on it. Let's go to El Paso, Texas, where Juan is listening to us on KTSM. Go ahead, Juan. Nice to have you with us tonight.
Thank you very much, gentlemen. Good evening. My argument here is due to our experience, our sister city across the border, Ciudad Juarez, Mexico. I was a witness as the army went down the street, disarming all the citizens of Ciudad Juarez 4 years ago, and the crime rate skyrocketed. And we're talking about very serious aggression, like kidnappings, carjackings, extortion, all the things that were never seen before just went rampant because the criminals were the only ones with weapons, and the army, 10,000 plus, they were unable to control it. So my argument is, us as U.S. citizens have the right to have right now the same firepower to deter if we ever have, God forbid, a situation like that.
All right, stay on the line. I want to expand on that. I want to give you the last word on it, but I want to expand it in the conversation that we have with our guests. With the people that you meet in your communities, the African-American communities of the south and west sides of Chicago, and when I talk about this in Chicago, I'm really talking about all over the United States. Right. And that is for the law-abiding citizen who is living in a crime-infested neighborhood. I don't see them in the forefront of the marches against let's ban guns. Don't they need guns to protect themselves against their neighbors, Teal?
Well, not necessarily, because what's going on is people are so they're dealing with a lot of other issues in the community. You know, you're dealing with poverty, you're dealing with dysfunctional families, and then people. Tupac, one of the greatest rappers that ever lived, and I can take a statement from him. Tupac said the only difference in the community, the people live next door to the murderers and the rapists. People from a distance say these are really bad communities. The people in the communities are scared as well, but everybody that lives in the neighborhood, they don't know nothing about no gun. You got a lot of the homeowners, they're scared, and they don't want to get involved in any type of violence as well. So the people that are involved in the violence, three times out of four times are the ones that are going to be shot. We do have innocent children being shot and killed as well in Chicago. I want to say that. But nine times out of ten, the people involved in that lifestyle, we have data to back that up. And understand this, 99% of the shootings in Chicago do not happen at the schools. Right. All those shootings take place outside of the schools. So the people in the community are just as terrified, but they're trying to go to work. They're trying to make sure their kids are okay, just like any other family in America.
Well, Anthony?
Well, I believe I'm a strong advocate of the Second Amendment. I think that we should have weapons in the home, I mean, to protect yourself. But, you know,
should you have an assault weapon in your home?
Now, you know, all of a sudden now in America, the word assault weapon has become a dirty word. Just last year, the Chicago Police Department collected 7,400 weapons. And out of those 7,400 weapons, only 300 of those weapons were assault weapons, assault rifles. Now, if you take that number and you extrapolate it out, handguns are the ones that are being used to commit murder, to commit crime all throughout this country. And so to ban an item or a weapon that's not doing the murdering, I mean, it seems counterproductive.
Juan, back to you in El Paso. Why, sure. Why is your choice of weapon, if I've heard you correctly, why is your choice of weapon to protect you and your family an assault weapon?
Well, that term assault is relative. I'm talking about like an AR-15 that I can go legally buy at the gun shop. It's a semi-automatic rifle with a 22 caliber high power round, which is what our military use, but they have fully automatic
weapons. But you can shoot the rounds rapidly. Is that the simple way to say that?
You shoot one at a time as fast as you can squeeze the trigger. One, okay. Every round. One trigger pull per
and
round.
And when you hold your finger on the trigger, does that make it an assault weapon? Is that where the difference takes place?
The difference is if you hold the trigger back, it's going to keep firing rounds that just keep firing.
Right. So my question to you then is, because again, I am not an expert on firearms, so you're educating me, and I need to be educated on this issue. Would you say that it's important to have the ability, as your right under the Second Amendment, to have a weapon that if you, when you hold the trigger, you can be shooting, you know, an X number of rounds a second? Is that important for you?
No, that's a fully automatic weapon, and that is a very hard to control weapon that takes has no place in the streets of the United States.
Okay, let me move up the Pacific Coast. Let's go to Spokane, Washington. Cal is listening. He is an owner of assault rifles as well. My question to you before you get to the question that you asked us, would you agree with Juan in El Paso that maybe that automatic weapon is not necessarily something that absolutely positively is needed to protect you and your family?
Well, probably not against, you know, the average assaultant, but my understanding of the Second Amendment was written to protect us from tyrannical governments and invading armies. So you would want to have a like weapon to what your enemy has.
So just so that I understand, and again, you know, there's a huge difference between people who live in rural America, although Spokane is a fairly large city, and people that live in a really large city like Chicago because of the violence. Can you understand why people that live in larger cities may want to restrict that Second Amendment interpretation more than you might?
I believe I do understand that, and there's two different aspects to this. The people walking down the streets of Spokane or Sprague, Washington, or wherever need to have an assault rifle? No, we don't need to have one. There's plenty of sporting rifles that will shoot around every time you pull the trigger. And they're not, they have wooden stocks. Really, that has a lot to do with the differentiation. Mm-hmm. If it's a wooden stock and a wooden forearm, it looks like a sporting rifle, but like a Remington 7400 has exactly the same function as an AR-15.
And you
every
had a
time you pull the trigger, it shoots a shell.
Stephanie's got a question for you, Cal.
You know, there's a couple things going on here, and I think Cal, you and I are going to agree on some of this. I think, and that is, first of all, what we're seeing here is part of the problem when we start talking about banning assault weapons, and that is really understanding and defining what is an assault weapon. I mean, technically, all weapons are used for assault purposes. However, understanding the technology of it, it gets very difficult. And that was part of the problem with the original assault weapons ban that expired in 2004. And that is, there were 900 exceptions as to what was an assault weapon. So we're going to have problems defining it. But more importantly,
which is why I asked the question the way I asked it, because an automatic, I guess what I'm talking about is on when you pull the trigger and the rounds keep shooting out.
Right. That's a fully automatic weapon. Being a former member,
a fully automatic.
Now that is banned in this country. Now, being a former member of the military, the standard issue weapon was the M16A1 rifle. That's now, with that rifle, you had just two modes. You had a single shot mode, which is pull a trigger, one shot. Pull a trigger, one shot. Now you can switch the trigger and you can pull it again, and they can shoot three shots at one time.
Yep.
But it was never a fully bang, bang, bang. Even, and that's a standard issue weapon. Now you have the AK-47, which is standard issue, that was a Russian weapon. That's a fully automatic weapon. So no matter how you hold that trigger down, you can easily get off 40, 50 rounds in 1 minute. Now you have some other larger weapons, which are squad automatic weapons, which the United States military uses. But we don't have those weapons, and those weapons are illegal in this country. But
would you acknowledge, though, and this is a question to you, Cal, would you acknowledge, and maybe Juan would acknowledge it as well, and that is, and you certainly alluded to it, that the concern of many gun owners who have assault rifles, your concern is not so much that a burglar is going to invade your home. Your concern is that an agency of government may invade your house and take away your rights.
That's correct. That's why our forefathers wrote in the Second Amendment for that very reason, because they had experienced that in England.
Yeah. Well, just to get back to Cal's point here, Cal, if you think for some strange reason that you're going to be at home with an assault-style weapon, and some member of the government wants to come by and take your weapon, and there's thousands and hundreds of thousands of government members out there, if you think that you're going to be able to, you know, hold the fort down when you got government officials coming to your door, trust me, it's not going to happen.
I want to get Cal's response.
It's not going to happen.
Cal, go
happen.
Ahead. That's what David Koresh thought. Go ahead.
I fully understand that. George Washington didn't fight the revolution alone either. Right. Yeah, they banded together and became a militia.
You're living in a totally different world between the 1700s and now 2013. But, we don't even have to be at your house to come get you.
You're getting off my track of my point here, totally. The point I called in was, originally the question was, should we own should we own assault rifles?
Yeah.
And to my point, I own three AR-15s. Mm-hmm. I drove a half an hour outside of Spokane this morning and went coyote hunting, and that's what I use it for. And I enjoy shooting it.
Okay.
And it's I don't use it for tactical reasons, but it's a good tool for what I enjoy doing, and that's predator hunting.
You had a suggestion also for teachers, I understand.
Yeah, if you look on the Kimber Firearms website, they have a little thing that looks like a Derringer. It's called a pepper blaster, and it shoots two shots of pepper 13 feet away at 90 miles an hour. So it is, if you get teachers slinging lead around a classroom, you're going to have as much incidental damage to your students as you are to the perpetrator.
I don't want teachers having guns. I want armed security in schools. I do not want them to be teachers. I have proposed that could be a jobs program for returning people, veterans from Afghanistan. Let's give guns to trained people. Back shortly. I'm Bruce Dumont. Thanks very much for joining us tonight live back in Chicago, and joining us around the table this evening, Stephanie Hitt is here. She is a mother of four, former assistant United States attorney, working with Rudy Giuliani in Manhattan. And Teal Hardiman joins us. He is the director of Cease Fire Illinois. That is an organization that's involved in a variety of cities. He's on the front line when you've been hearing these horrible stories about the crime rate in Chicago. Teal has been out there working in an intervention capacity, trying to stop these crimes from happening. A very difficult job at a very difficult time. So I want to just, you know, thank you for doing what you do and trying to make life a little safer here in the city of Chicago. And again, we're trying to deal with some of the issues that would give you a little more help. I didn't want to say ammunition, but a little more help in what you do. Anthony Anderson is here. He's in the criminal justice system 20 years. He's a former United States Marine Corps veteran, and he has been in the criminal justice system. And briefly tell everybody what you do in 20 words or less, or 15 words or less. Or
I work for the Illinois Department of Juvenile Justice. I've been there for about 20 years. I've worked in the adult divisions at Danville Correctional Center. I've been at Pontiac, worked there for a few days, I guess, and also at Illinois Youth Center Joliet.
So you work with people that have broken the law
through and through.
And when you look at them every day, it must frustrate you that those faces that you see will probably someday be back again.
Of course. I mean, the recidivism rate in Illinois is beyond reproach. The unfortunate thing is, you know, a lot of times I'm seeing the same old faces all the time. And a lot of times these same individuals, they actually graduate. We call it graduate and go from the
the juvenile division straight to the adult division. It's like a culture.
Someone has said, I don't remember what it was, but in the last couple of months, I've heard the term that, you know, that sort of trying to define insanity. Mm-hmm. Insanity is doing the same thing that you always do, expecting a different response. Mm-hmm. And it seems to me that in the criminal justice system and the propensity to incarcerate people in the United States, that policy is insane. Mm-hmm. Because we're doing the same things and we're expecting a better result. When you send someone to prison and there are no training programs, exactly. how can any smart person with any brain at all think that at the end of 3, 5, or 10 years, after they have basically been surrounded by people who are lawbreakers without any training, without any intervention, how does anyone believe that when that person gets out, they're going to be able to come back into society? And that's why the recidivism rate, the rate of people returning to prisons, is so high.
And to add insult to injury, Bruce, one of the things is the fact of the matter is most people, unfortunately, live longer the more they stay in jail. I mean, it's just a fact of the matter. Most of those guys, they come to jail, and the fact of the matter is we'll see them come back and forth. We know that they're going to live for the next year or so because they're incarcerated. That's the fact of the matter.
And sometimes, sometimes, unfortunately, this is pretty tragic, but unfortunately, a lot of people who go to prison, not only is it a status system, a situation, which you talked about earlier in the program, it's the only place where they can get a cot and a meal three times a day.
Absolutely.
So they keep going back maybe because they may want to go back.
This is, and in most cases, this is almost better than home.
Let's go to Lee in Hammond, Indiana, listening to us on WLS Radio. Go ahead, Lee.
How you doing, Bruce?
How are you? How yourself, sir?
Okay, I'll make this quick. My battery's going dead.
Yeah, I know. You've been waiting a long time. I apologize.
I just wanted to ask the panel. You know, to me, it's interesting that the news media has not actually seemed to show any interest in, you know, finding out whether or not these perpetrators and these mass shootings have been on antipsychotic drugs. Mm-hmm. Just about every one of them has had a history mm-hmm. of contact with mental care providers, yet there's no interest in actually getting out to the public whether or not they've been on these drugs and some of the side effects of these things are murderous and suicidal thoughts.
Well, I think that's a very good point. I agree with you that it has not been discussed. It is one very small piece of this broad issue of the mental health aspect of this.
I think, caller, that's due in large part to the stigma that's associated with having some sort of mental incapacities. But, Teal, go ahead.
Well, that's just the thing. I have a lot of friends, believe it or not, that are incarcerated. And one of my friends just told me during a collect phone call conversation that there are long lines of young men that are incarcerated in places like Pontiac, Stateville, that are waiting for their medication. And there was some research that was put out there about a year ago that 57 million Americans outside of the penal justice system are on antidepressant medication. So there's definitely a chronic problem with antidepressant and psychotropic drugs.
Lee's point, rather, it's not a problem. Lee, if I'm hearing you correctly, you're not saying that I don't think you're saying that prescription drugs are not warranted for some people.
No.
People can forget to take their medication. You know, if I forget to take my diabetes medicine, I feel worse.
But, you know, the thing is, I wonder, you know, since the known side effects of these things are suicidal and murderous thoughts, is it because of the power of the drug industry and lobby? I mean, we're hearing all this talk about restricting gun access and that kind of thing, but there's no word out of Washington or nothing in the news media about these drugs.
Good point.
You know, and I think part of the problem is, you know, there are, for many, many families who have children with ADHD and so on, you know, these drugs.